And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم و بین استعین صلی الله علیه و آله عبد الله السلام علیکم و رحمت الله و برکاته. This is an episode of the program The Dialogue and I'm Dr. Fakhr Rouhani. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam took respite only the eve of Ashura, the eve, the night when the ensuing day was the day of Ashura. Well, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam intended to spend the last day of his life in this world on performing salat, on reciting the Holy Quran, and on encouraging his companions. In fact, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam also encouraged his companions to join him, to remain steadfast with him without any kind of imposition at all. And then Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam's interpretation was in such a way that this worldly life, especially life under the supervision and command of such tyrants, would be nothing but abasement. And then the martyrdom would certainly be a new life and a new kind of inspiration and a new type of livelihood in the time of the tyrants. From this indication, it must be indicated that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam encouraged his companions to regard it, to regard that situation as an unfavorable situation because of the ruling power was none but Yazid ibn Muawiyah. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam analogized this world, the relation between this world and the afterworld, space or a place where one should cross, for example, a river by means of walking over a bridge. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam analogized enjoying the other world, the afterlife, as crossing this bridge and moving from this side of a river to the other side. So simple. And at the same time, we find that on the eve of Ashura, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam spent his last day in this world all in performing salat, in reciting the Holy Quran, and encouraged his steadfast and loyal companions to remain so and to make themselves busy with performing these rituals. At the same time, we find that in the school of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, such kind of steadfastness comes from a firm belief in the saviorhood of the Holy Quran and the feature of tranquility giver in the act of performing such rituals like salat and reciting the Holy Quran, because they are closer to one's spiritual aspect. At the same time, it must be indicated that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam insisted on the relationship between salat and jihad. And we find that from the perspective of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, jihad meant nothing but supporting the Islamic religion. So you find that what Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam achieved on the day of Ashura was sacrificing his life for the sake of strengthening the Islamic religion and preventing it from going astray. Thank you. As-salamu alayka ya Aba
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always. عليك مني
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For the first time since the beginning of the UN brokered agreement in April, Yemenis are waiting in long lines in front of a limited number of operating petrol stations in the capital Sana'a to refill their vehicles. Yemen is suffering from a fresh fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's ongoing blockade.
The Saudi-led coalition wasn't sincere in implementing the terms of the armistice, and it did not open flights to other destinations from Sana'a Airport, and the salary issue still persists. The enemy is still using various methods to pressure the Yemenis, such as seizing fuel ships. But our leadership is studying the positions that can be taken regarding the Saudi violations of the UN armistice. There will be an appropriate decision at the right time, as the leadership is keen to move towards a solution to end the war.
The Yemeni Petroleum Company announced the implementation of the emergency plan and is distributing fuel to a few stations only. It held the United Nations responsible for the consequences of the Saudi violation, as it did not ensure the implementation of the armistice terms that included allowing fuel ships to enter Yemen without any restrictions.
The fuel crisis that the liberated areas are experiencing contradicts the United Nations statements that there is a smooth flow of entry of fuel ships into the Port of Hodeida. If there had been a smooth entry, we would not have experienced this crisis. The UN is a clear partner in the decision posed on the Yemeni people, because it did not force a Saudi-led coalition to implement what was agreed upon. We hold the United Nations responsible for the continued violations of the Saudi-led coalition.
Since the beginning of the truce, only 33 fuel ships out of 54 have entered the country. However, Riyadh is still holding 9 fuel ships despite them obtaining UN permits, and this is a clear violation of the UN brokered agreement.
Observers believe that the Saudi seizure of oil ships and the Yemeni army's recent military parades indicate a return to military escalation. They say the UN brokered truce has failed to achieve tangible results in relieving the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Liz Truss has begun celebrations after winning the race to become the new leader of the ruling Conservative Party, making her the next British Prime Minister, beating her rival finalist Rishi Sunak and taking over the post from her predecessor Boris Johnson. The Foreign Secretary, who won 81,326 votes of Tory members to the former Chancellor's 60,000, takes over from Boris Johnson, who was ousted by his own MPs earlier this summer.
I'd like to pay tribute to my fellow candidates, particularly Rishi Sunak. It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party. Friends and colleagues, thank you for putting your faith in me to lead our great Conservative Party, the greatest political party on earth.
The feeling of joy over her victory will not last long. Truss has taken over a car crash economy and a so-called zombie government. Building a new cabinet, formulating an effective energy plan, and figuring out how to remove pressure of the severe cost of living crisis are all top of the agenda.
Things in Britain do need to change. We need some new policies, because what's been happening recently is there's a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Inflation is at its highest amount for several decades now, and this is alarming. Britain's economic future is quite bleak. Businesses are suffering. Indeed, there could be the position that many factories may have to close, perhaps temporarily, because simply they cannot afford the fuel bills. So something, in a sense, must be done.
Truss inherits a deeply divided party, lagging in the polls, and a long line of past scandals have left many experts fearing lasting damage to Tory electoral prospects. Truss won't officially take over until Tuesday after a meeting with the Queen alongside the outgoing Mr. Johnson. However, her next big fight will be to convince the wider electorate that her premiership has a future. Robert Carter, London.
Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel operation. In September of last year, 6 Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the 6 prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The 6 escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al Masila. At a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemeni suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations. As Yemenis face a fuel crash due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of 3 British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers.
An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality.
Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across, and that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters. But choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has criticized Zionist regime's crimes against innocent Palestinian prisoners, saying that the martyrdom of some prisoners in jail reflects the policy of lingering killing of detainees in Israeli prisons. Palestinian detainees have endlessly resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at their illegal administrative detention. Zionist regime jails authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under dire conditions without proper hygienic and health standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression. Human rights organizations say the Zionist regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to Palestinian prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media to shed more light on the issue. Stay with us to hear more about the story. The website of Middle East Eye has published an article concerning this issue, saying Palestinian groups have charged Israeli regime with medical negligence that led to the martyrdom of prisoner Musa Harun Abu Mohammed on Saturday, September 3rd. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, PPC, the 40-year-old was detained 2 months ago while attempting to enter the city of Al-Quds from the occupied West Bank for work. Israeli forces claimed he did not have a permit to work in Al-Quds at the time. His family said he was suffering from a neurological disorder before his arrest and that his condition deteriorated in jail. He was transferred to Asaf Hurwey Hospital at the beginning of August. The PPC said that Israeli authorities informed the family of Abu Mohammed that his body would be handed back for burial later on Saturday, September 3rd. The PPC noted in a statement Abu Mohammed was subjected to the crime of deliberate medical negligence. Abu Mohammed's martyrdom comes days after some 1,000 Palestinian prisoners suspended their hunger strike after Israeli prison authorities accepted to their demands to reverse harsh measures imposed across prisons for months. The strike was part of a series of escalating steps the prisoners had adopted since February amid the Israeli refusal to respond to their demands to reverse measures taken against them following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa prison in September last year. Palestinian rights groups charged Israeli prison services of adopting a systematic policy of deliberate medical negligence against Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Center for Human Rights website pchrgaza.org wrote, Abu Mohammed's martyrdom sheds the light on the general deterioration of Palestinian detainees' conditions in the Israeli jails, as there are 7,000 Palestinians, including 175 children and 32 women, detained in 23 prisons and detention facilities inside the occupied territories in inhuman and cruel conditions that lack the standard minimum rules of the treatment of prisoners and detainees in detention. Among the detainees, there are 600 ill detainees. Some of them suffer chronic and serious diseases. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, 231 security detainees have attained martyrdom in the Israeli prisons, including dozens who have martyred due to medical negligence policy since 1967. PCHR hereby holds the Israeli occupation authorities fully responsible for the martyrdom of Palestinian detainee Mohammed, who is the fourth detainee attained martyrdom in Israeli jails since the beginning of 2022, and for the lives of hundreds of ill detainees who would face the same fate if the policy of deliberate medical negligence continued, especially under the unhealthy imprisonment conditions where prisoners are denied adequate health care. Similarly, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, said, calls for a prompt and impartial investigation into Mohammed's martyrdom circumstances are needed. It also calls upon the International Committee of Red Crescent, ICRC, to intensify and ensure efficacy of their follow-up of the conditions of Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and their imprisonment conditions. Also, it calls upon the international community to compel Israel to respect the rules of the international law and international humanitarian law, in particular the Fourth Geneva Convention and the UN standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners. Moreover, SaveTheChildren.org said, children in the Israeli military detention system face inhumane treatment such as beatings, strip searches, psychological abuse, weeks in solitary confinement, and being denied access to a lawyer during interrogations. The charity Save the Children consulted more than 470 children from across the West Bank who have been detained over the past 10 years. It found that most children were taken from their homes at night, blindfolded with their hands painfully bound behind their backs. Many of the respondents said they were not told why they were being arrested or where they were being taken. Every year, hundreds of Palestinian children are detained by Israeli authorities. They are the only children in the world who are systematically prosecuted through military rather than civilian courts. The most common charge is throwing stones, for which the maximum sentence is 20 years in prison. After this arrest, children are transferred to interrogation centers where they report being forced to lie face down on the metal floor of military vehicles, denied bathroom breaks, deprived of food and water, and physically assaulted. Children describe the detention experience as torturous, dehumanizing, humiliating, and terrifying. Save the Children's consultation showed that 81% endured physical beatings and 89% suffered verbal abuse. 52% were threatened with harm to their families. 86% were subjected to strip searches, leaving them humiliated and ashamed. 88% did not receive adequate and timely health care, even when explicitly requested, and almost half, 47%, were denied contact with a lawyer. Save the Children asked the Zionist regime to respect international law and to end the detention and mistreatment of the innocent children and other Palestinian detainees under military law. Israeli authorities must immediately adopt practical safeguards to improve the situation for children who are currently detained. This includes ending the systematic ill-treatment of children, establishing protection and safeguards for detainees, and providing adequate services to support girls and boys to recover from their experiences. Meanwhile, a Palestinian Commission for Prisoners says that the number of Palestinian prisoners held under Israel's so-called administrative detention has increased to 700. The Palestinian Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs said in a statement recently that the reason for the surge is that Israel has intensified its administrative detention orders in recent months, particularly in occupied East Al-Quds. The commission further noted that the Palestinian administrative detainees often resort to hunger strikes to secure their release from prison, adding that some inmates have gone on hunger strike for more than 150 days before securing their freedom. More than 7,000 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in about 23 Israeli jails. Hundreds of detainees, including women and minors, are being held under administrative detention. Rights groups describe Israel's use of the detention system as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end its use. Under the administrative detention, Israel keeps Palestinians without charge for up to 6 months, a period that can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrowshahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarai that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Shia dignitaries, scholars, ulama, and authors all across the world of Islam. For today's discussion, I have two very special guest speakers, one from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi, and another from the University of Qom, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to your show.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
And Dr. Fakhr, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, thank you.
Today we want to talk about the late Allama Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi, the author of Nahjul Sa'ada fi Mustadrak al-Nahjul Balagha. This is his magnum opus. We will talk, inshallah, more about this book. But first, let's take a look at his biography and life. Sheikh Mahdavi, give us some information about the personal and scholarly life of this outstanding man, that is Allama Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allama Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi is born in 1302, according to solar calendar, and passed away in 1385. He is regarded as one of the outstanding faqih, muhaddis, mutakallim, historian, muwarrikh, and catechologist of Shias, who mainly studied in Najaf. Actually, his ancestors are regarded from the great ulama, not his father, because in his biography, when he is asked that, do you know the exact time of your birthday, he is saying that because my father was a farmer and he didn't know how to write and how to learn, he didn't register my birthday exactly. Okay. So only my grandfather and his ancestors are regarded from the great ulama that were giving the religious services in their area. When he was 19 years old, he decided to leave his hometown, which is Alamardash, one of the cities of the province of Shiraz.
Yes.
He left Alamardash to Najaf, but he has a very nice story, which is regarded as the beginning of the difficulties and problems that he took in his religious journey up until he becomes a great Allama. And he also narrates that I really suffered during this long journey.
That's right.
And as an example, he is saying that the time I wanted to leave Alamardash to Najaf, the only way to go there, I had to go to Bushehr. So from there up to Bushehr, it's almost 300 kilometers. Okay. He's saying that I was forced to walk because I didn't have any money, because that time people would take a horse and donkeys to move these from one place to another place. So I walked up until the Bushehr, and from Bushehr, I took a ship. I stayed in one island, Khark, and from Khark, I went to Abadan.
And we know that the weather situation over there is really hot.
Yes, yes, yeah. You know, so he's saying that when I arrived in Najaf, we had a very far relative over there, and they didn't accept to have me among themselves. Why? Because they asked, do you have any money with you that you want to stay in Najaf? Okay. I said, no, I don't have any money with me. The only thing that I had was one abba, or garments, that I gave it to someone to take me from Karbala up to here. So a very difficult situation. He actually is narrating the suffering and difficulties that he started his journey to stay in Najaf, the way that one of those relative gathering accepted, okay, no matter, you can stay here, I will give some portion of the money that you might be in need to go and buy the book, to go and buy the clothes, I mean the these specific wearing of talabe. So finally, Amir al-Mu'mineen, after so many testers, accepts him to be next to Amir al-Mu'mineen and stays there. And he starts his scholarly life till he arrives to the point that we see that many of the great ulama, like Allama Shahid Mutahhari, when he comes across with one of his books, like Nahjus Sa'adah, is saying that this is the best collection of the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Yes.
And
yes,
Nahjus Sa'adah is only one of his works, then inshallah, that's in our right. discussion today, we are going to cover his works and his yes. achievements, inshallah.
Okay, and the sincerity and the endeavor that they, and the dedication that they had, really, we can say, make the path towards salvation, both in this world and the other world, especially, as you said, helped them a lot in compiling such outstanding works like Nahjus Sa'adah, which is really outstanding, you know. After Nahjul Balagha, I think the best one is Nahjus Sa'adah, as the collection of the sayings and all, we can say, the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which can be referred to and is really authentic. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, let's be a little bit concerned with his scholarly life. What information can you give us?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin astain. First of all, it must be indicated that as dear friend and colleague, Mr. Mahdawi, has pointed out, the late Allama Mahmoudi was a really self-motivated scholar in his academic career. And it's really very very hard to imagine such a dedicated person in a remote, at a remote village to try to, I mean, to leave his hometown or home region
yes.
and to go to Najaf rather on foot, okay? At the same time, when Allama Mahmoudi reached the Najaf, it was certainly the golden period of the Najaf Hawza and Najaf Seminary. This is because great ulama were available over there.
Yes.
And compared with other cities where, for example, researchers might not be able to avail themselves of very fine books and nice libraries, everything was expected to be ready, I mean, readily at hand in Najaf. That's this right. is one. And another one is that at that time, Allama Mahmoudi came in contact, in personal contact with great luminaries of the Najaf Seminary, like the late Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Tabatabai Hakim, Ayatollah Khoi, Ayatollah Shahrudi, and others.
That's right.
And they left a long-lasting impression on his mind and on his academic career. In this regard, I should like to say that he devoted his life, first of all, his academic life, to selecting, I mean, classic, historical classics of the lives of the infallibles, mainly those written by Sunnis, like, for example, Tabaqat ibn Sa'd and others, for example. He decided to produce critical editions.
Yes.
I mean, annotated and critical editions of those works.
This is what we call it, Mustadrak, isn't it?
Mustadrak, yes.
Okay.
And in this regard, it must be indicated that, I mean, parenthetically, I should like to say that I've read many of his books,
okay.
and I've consulted many of the books that he edited and he published.
That's right.
Not in Iran, but elsewhere. For example, of Ibn Sa'd's Tabaqat, I mean, which is a very, I mean, detailed biographical literature. I mean, he selected the chapters or the, I mean, sections devoted to Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam Al Hassan, Imam Al Hussein, Imam Al Sajjad alayhi salam, and produced a very detailed exegetical and annotated edition of those texts. In some cases, he makes references to other sources, or in some cases, he comes to provide the correct form of certain expressions in the text.
That's all right.
Because as you know, okay. some spelling mistakes yes. or some typos
yes.
might create some misunderstanding for the later generations. But the late Ayatollah Allama Mahmoudi, I mean, he himself, when he was busy with publishing okay. some of his works in Lebanon, in Beirut,
yes.
I knew well that, because at that time I was living over there, I knew that he was very meticulous.
That's
so
right.
he wasn't such a person to give his book to a publisher and go home. Rather, he was such a person
That's
that
right.
every day from morning up to the evening,
okay.
he was busy with, I mean, together with the publisher and a typesetter, he was always, I mean, busy with, I mean, creating the best exegetical types of the text that he was going to reproduce.
That's all right.
Not mechanical reproduction, yes. but academic, I mean, appraisal of the text.
That's all right. And I think this was his interest, because it gets to establishing a center for the revival of Islamic culture
yes.
in Islamic Republic of Iran, isn't it? And yes. Over there, all his interests, it's called yes. interests, you know, were actualized. So many compilations and so many works. He has also so many works about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes,
as you said, correction, revision, and re-edition of so many outstanding works, which are really great, and he was truly a scholar. But still, he is known by his book, Nahj al-Sa'ada fi Mustadrak al-Nahj al-Balagha. What is this book, and what was his research methodology in this book, Sheikh Madhavi?
Okay, regarding Nahj al-Sa'ada, I think our listeners and audience, if they get some sort of information about the number of the khutbah, speeches, and also messages, letters, and the short sayings of Imam Ali, which are collected in the Nahj al-Balagha that they are familiar with, and make a comparison with Nahj al-Sa'ada, they might get the value and the hard working that Allama Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi has put forth in order to compile such a precious compilation.
Yes.
So when you go through this normal Nahj al-Balagha that we are familiar with, we see the number of the speeches or khutab is 241, which in Nahj al-Sa'ada, based on the vast research that he did, he succeeded to compile 500 khutbah.
Okay.
It means twice Nahj al-Balagha. Mm-hmm. The number of the khutbah which are compiled in his collection is almost twice this normal or ordinary book that we are familiar with. And the number of the letters or messages of Amir al-Mu'mineen to his governors or enemies, friends, and companions. In Nahj al-Balagha, the number of the letters reaches 79, but in Nahj al-Sa'ada, we have something around 300, almost four times,
yes.
Nahj al-Balagha.
Yes.
And also we see that we have the category of du'as.
Uh-huh, supplications.
The category of supplication. And the time he was alive, he was living in this world, the chapter of the short sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen has not published yet.
Yes.
But I'm aware because I have some sort of engagement with the center that you mentioned,
yes.
which is located in Qom, the center for the reviving of the
Islamic culture.
Yes, Islamic culture.
Yes.
Majma'e Ihya'e Farhangi Islami.
Yes.
Right now, it's under the process. They are trying to have a very good compilation with a good certification and giving very good references from which book this short saying of Amir al-Mu'mineen has been quoted, and they are dropping and removing all repeating sayings in order to have a very clear and neat job for the listeners.
Very good.
So when we look at such a huge work being done by one author, it shows us the amount of the efforts that he put forth. He himself is saying that I was really close to Allama Amini to the point that I was given this permission to stay in his library 24 hours, and I would say anybody, when it reaches the time that you want to close the doors,
okay.
close the door, don't come in, I don't need anything, no water, no bread, nothing, I prefer to stay here. And he says that above 1,000 book I read in order to compile such a precious collection. And we know, and at that time they didn't have access to the computer the way that we are doing, so we easily Google part of the saying, and then we may find or may not. Sometimes we see that something that they have achieved is not even comparable to what we may achieve through all these sophisticated gadgets, computers, and whatsoever we have. So it's really, really outstanding work that he did. Also, my short addition, maybe I'm going to end my talk with this, that for audience and listeners, they're familiar with the great personality of Ayatollah al-Uzma, Safi Gulpayegani. Recently,
yes.
1 year ago,
yes.
he passed away. He says that the works of Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi must be introduced to everyone
mm-hmm.
without having any hesitation.
That's right.
So it shows that how his works are really informative,
yes.
Free from flaws or mistakes. That
That's right.
He says such words with this certainty that his works all
must be introduced to everyone.
That's all right. And we know that for doing research on the statements and the sayings and the aphorisms of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he did not only refer to the Shiite references, but all the denominations inside Islam. And this makes his work and the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we can say, the content more interesting for the whole Muslim communities all across the world. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, Nahjus Sa'ada fi Mustadrak Nahjul Balagha, brother, how did you find this book? Is this book at all translated into English language or not?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Unfortunately, while a colleague and friend, Sheikh Mahdavi, was talking, I was thinking about a process or a trend of introducing this rich Shia legacy to the world. And yes, the only pathway must be translation into English, because right, when you translate something from any language into English, you help it get internationalized.
That's
and
right,
universalized.
Okay.
Okay. However, in this regard, I should like to say that apart from the whole book, I mean, which hasn't been put into English, which hasn't been translated to English, unfortunately, so far as I know, this book must be categorized among the thousands of other valuable books and
yes,
sources that hasn't received even a synopsis in English, let alone
yes,
any, for example, brief translation or, for example, an overview.
And Nahjus Sa'ada fi Mustadrak Nahjul Balagha is the most comprehensive book
yes,
regarding, we can say, the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes, in this regard, it must
okay,
be indicated that, first of all, if not a complete translation, at least a descriptive
yes,
bibliographical introduction
yes. Yes, yes,
or a detailed and graphic synopsis or summary of the book
mm-hmm,
should be produced in English
yes,
so that it would be accessible to others. Because when you translate something, when you translate an introduction to a book from any local language into English, at least you show this pathway to researchers from other cultures or other,
right,
languages, okay, or other communities, okay, that, for example, this valuable item is available, okay, and this is a short introduction to it in English. But
okay,
so long as, this first or this initial step hasn't been taken, okay, we cannot expect other people to come and identify it. In this regard, I should like to say that there is a center in Qom, Bunyad Nahjul Balagha Foundation in Qom.
Yes.
I visited a couple of times. Unfortunately, they are not that active in the realm of English. They mainly focus on Persian and sometimes on Arabic texts. So it must be indicated that, such books and such sources still await good and introductory translations
That's
into
right,
English.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fakhwani and Sheikh Mahdavi. The late Allama Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi passed away on Farvardin 27, 1385, according to the solar calendar. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Lady Fatima to Masuma in the holy city of Qom, and he was buried over there. And we really missed one of the most outstanding revivers of the Shiite legacy, and Imam Ali alayhi salam, the author of Nahjus Sa'ada fi Mustadrak Nahjul Balagha, which is really a magnum opus. And I really invite our dear listeners, brothers and sisters, all across the world of Islam to refer to this book if they want to be more familiar with the character and universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam through his own words. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Fakhwani.
Welcome.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information and to download for free our previous episodes, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.